Deutsche Welle. Inside Europe.
Hello there, and welcome to Inside Europe. I'm Gabriel Borud in Bonn. On today's program, Greeks look for more creative ways to vent their anger.
Έλληνες προσοχή! Ανάμεσά σας κυκλοφορούν κι άλλοι Έλληνες.
Greeks, beware. In your midst there are more Greeks.
Also on Inside Europe, the Spanish people stand up to a growing problem resulting from the crisis, evictions. In France, controversy surrounds plans to build the country's first Mormon temple, and we look at whether Christianity is too present in British public life. Those stories and more coming up on Inside Europe. After months of fraught negotiation, the Greeks have won a second bailout from the European Union and the International Monetary Fund. The multi-billion euro package of loans will help the country avoid a messy default later this month. But it won't bring any immediate economic relief to the people of Greece. They have had to accept another round of tough austerity measures and another sharp decline in their standard of living. Many are likely to stage further angry protests in the streets of Athens. But Greeks of a less violent disposition have been venting their fury and frustration in other ways, through satire, song, and even opera. From Athens, Stephen Beard reports.
Laden with debt, plunging into poverty, humiliated by the rest of Europe, the Greeks have co-produced an opera about the debt crisis. It's a comedy. The triumphal march from Aida, not with trumpets, but with kazoos. Like Verdi's original, this modern adaptation is about conquerors and slaves. But here the conqueror is not an Egyptian pharaoh, he's the German head of the European Central Bank, and he comes to Athens to sort out the debt problem. Haralampos Hoyos is with the production.
There's been a lot of talk about a new kind of German occupation of Greece. It reflects the truth that Greek people really feel that they are not masters of their destiny and of their life.
The comic opera is a joint production between German and Greek opera companies. So far, it's played only in Germany, to packed, enthusiastic houses.
The German people were not only laughing, but also cheering and applauding and banging their feet. And everybody, after the show, was coming to us and trying to speak in Greek, and I think it changed something.
The opera comes to Greece soon. We'll see then whether the Greeks find it as hilarious as the Germans. Certainly the Greeks have, in the past, seen the funny side of the crisis. This satirical stage show was a big hit in Athens last year.
Ελλάδα 2011. Μια χώρα σε αποσύνθεση.
The show, called The Foundation, lampooned the Germans for allegedly bullying the Greeks and throwing their weight around in Athens. But it also ridiculed the Greeks for their alleged lack of foresight and discipline. Yannis Sarakatsanis is one of the cast.
Because we realized that we always found someone else to blame, and we wanted at last to do a show and go to the audience and say, it's your fault, you Greek.
Έλληνες προσοχή. Ανάμεσά σας κυκλοφορούν κι άλλοι Έλληνες.
He says, Greeks, beware. In your midst there are more Greeks. But while the show wowed audiences in Athens last year, this year it bombed. As unemployment has soared above 21% and 48% for young people, as the spending cuts have bitten more deeply and the tax hikes have begun to hurt, Greeks have lost their appetite for satire, says Yannis.
Political satire looks... it's like making fun about someone who's dead.
It's not funny anymore.
Exactly, it's not funny. It is a problem now, and people are afraid.
Vasu Kavaleiuratu, another member of the cast, says satire was easy in the early days of the crisis, when, underneath it all, she believed that things would get better fairly soon.
I was thinking that, you know, I had a hope. I was hoping that something would change. Now it's the first time that I really don't know what's going to happen. And this is scary, yeah.
Μαύρος ουρανός.
This gloomy song called Cazzarola seems more in tune now with the national mood. Among the lyrics, there are lines like poverty and dead end. Planet Earth is bleeding. There's sadness and bitterness at the ports. It's not that Greeks are going hungry, but after more than 4 years of recession, the downward pressure on their standard of living is gathering pace. Despina Katsumba is a professional archaeologist. Her salary was recently cut in half. She's concerned about the effect the crisis is having on her 7-year-old daughter's development.
She likes very much reading. And what makes me very, very angry, last year I was buying her a book every week. Now I can't do that. She asks me for a book and I can't afford it.
Many Greeks have sublimated their anger and resentment through song and satire and art. But this is a country that feels at the end of its tether. More strikes and street protest now seem the more likely medium of expression. Stephen Beard, Deutsche Welle Radio, Athens.
From the causes of the debt crisis to its consequences, we move now to Spain, one of Western Europe's most stricken countries. It's almost hard to believe, but in Spain right now, there are millions of new houses that are empty. There's nothing wrong with them. Many families would want to live in them, but those families can't afford them. Back during the country's property boom, a house was easy to come by, and a mortgage dirt cheap. But now, with Spain's unemployment crisis growing to record levels, most of the people that took those mortgages can't make the payments. Last year alone, Spanish authorities repossessed well over 50,000 properties, putting many families in dire need. Anger in the population as a result has now led to a nationwide protest movement to stop the evictions. Tom Burridge reports from Madrid.
It's early in the morning. And in a few hours, Ronaldo Lacruz's home is due to be repossessed. But he's got company. A group of protesters have stayed the night. And as day breaks, more arrive on the street outside. Homes without people and people without homes is one chant. Spain's property bubble not only created lots of empty buildings, it also tempted lots of people into mortgages they now can't afford. Ronald moved to Spain from the Dominican Republic 8 years ago. He worked in construction, bought this house, and then lost his job. I'm one of many, he tells me. If the bank decides today to give me social housing, it doesn't solve anything, he says. It's a problem that's affecting more and more of us.
The atmosphere here has changed completely because the police are definitely arriving. There's two police cars we can see at one end of the street. A police van was just at the other end. They seem to be driving around the block, checking out the protesters who have really huddled in front of the front door of the property in an attempt to block the police from moving in.
Tatiana joined this protest movement when it began. She's been to 50 protests and now her house is due to be repossessed.
I mean, if someone enters into a mortgage, they have to pay the payments that they owe. I mean, do you not agree with that principle?
No estoy de acuerdo con este principal. No estoy de acuerdo con esto porque aquí nosotros nos han engañado.
I don't agree because we were tricked. They created a property bubble and they gave mortgages to everyone, even to people who weren't legally registered to be here, people without stable jobs. It was fraud in every sense of the word.
It's an accusation I put to Antonio Romero from the Association of Spanish Savings Banks. They issue the vast amount of mortgages in Spain.
I think we should take into account the context in which lending contracts were held. They took place in the highest, let's say, peak of the cycle in the Spanish economy, where the credit was easy to get, were very cheap, and when Spanish unemployment rate was really low.
After negotiations via his lawyer and a plea from nuns who work at his children's school, Ronald walks around the corner onto the main road to meet with a representative from his bank. Surrounded by the media and several police vans called in to carry out the eviction, he signs an agreement giving him 8 more days to pay, leave his home, or face the prospect of another eviction. The protesters celebrate, but it's likely to be a temporary victory before the police return. Many of those affected are immigrants like Ronal, but the homes of young Spanish couples are also being repossessed in large numbers. Both groups were tempted to buy when a home seemed a cheap and easy commodity. Now even the humblest apartment has become a battleground between a social movement and the Spanish authorities. Tom Burridge, DW, Madrid.
And I'm Gabriel Borud in Bonn. You're listening to Inside Europe. The United States may get its first Mormon president this year if Republican candidate Mitt Romney prevails in his bid. But in France, the religion is sparking controversy over a project to build the country's first Mormon temple. Mormons in France at the moment, who attend normal churches for their Sunday services, are forced to travel abroad for special ceremonies like weddings that have to take place in temples. The French Mormon community is one of the largest in Europe, and now they want their own house of worship. Lisa Bryant has more on the debate from the Paris suburb of Chennai.
Alors attendez, où est-il? Où est-il? Ben voilà, c'est très simple. Vous voyez les fumées là en ce moment qui sont en train de sortir?
Past clusters of houses and frozen fields, the 17th century Versailles Palace sparkles in the afternoon sun. But from his office window, Chennai Mayor Philippe Briot points to a more prosaic landmark, an abandoned asbestos-choked power plant. This is the property that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has acquired to build France's first Mormon temple.
When we saw the client, we weren't overjoyed, because the Mormons have an image that's pretty negative, even if it's not deserved.
Briot says he ultimately granted the Mormons their building permit after an investigation he commissioned found no reason to refuse it. With 36,000 members, the Mormon Church in France is among the oldest and largest in Europe. Missionaries arrived here from the United States in the 1850s. But only recently have ordinary French become aware of the Mormon faith, partly through media reports about U.S. presidential candidate Mitt Romney, who spent time here in the 1960s as a young Mormon missionary, and partly because of concerns about the temple project in Chennai, a small town west of Paris.
On s'aperçoit aux États-Unis que les Mormons sont peut-être des gens comme les autres et que peut-être...
We see from the United States that Mormons are like anybody else. And maybe in a few years, if Romney is elected, we'll say we've done a good thing because the President of the United States is a Mormon.
And here we are in the real chapel, that is where we have the Sunday meetings, where we take the sacrament every Sunday, which is distributed to the members.
Today, France's Mormon community gathers in ordinary churches, like this one in the nearby town of Versailles. But church spokesman Christian Evrard says there are special ceremonies, like weddings or sealings binding families spiritually, that can only take place in temples.
I really believe that France, with the principles of separation of church and state, or with the principle of human rights and the fact that religious freedom is one of the principles of the Constitution, should really have a temple. We have a Buddhist pagoda, we have present temples and synagogues, which is absolutely necessary. So I think a Mormon temple is not a problem.
For now, Mormons in France, like 40-year-old American Darla Pape, who attends a Versailles church with her family, must travel to Britain or Germany to go to temple.
For us, going to the temple is a wonderful experience. It's a time to contemplate things going on in our life, a time to contemplate things that we've learned about the gospel, things that we've learned in the scriptures. It's a time of peace for us.
But opposition to the temple project is growing. An internet petition against the project has already gathered 6,000 signatures, although Mayor Briot says most are not Chennai residents. Some of the criticism is political and aired by the mayor's personal opponents. But others, like Marie Drion, local chapter head of UNADFI, a group fighting against religious extremism, view the project and the Mormon religion with skepticism.
Prosélytisme est aussi quand même... fait partie de cette église comme des églises.
Proselytizing is part of the Mormon Church, like with the evangelical and Pentecostal churches, which Europe isn't used to. And it introduces marketing methods to convince people. In our country, which has seen a lot of blood spilled in religious wars, this isn't an acceptable practice.
Drion also believes the church isn't fully transparent to the public, including about its more unusual practices, such as proxy baptisms for the dead. On the streets of Chennai, opinion is divided. Resident Véronique Landé says she's heard of Mormons from television reports.
Je suis un peu troublée, je connais pas beaucoup non plus, donc c'est vrai.
But I'll say I don't know much about them, and I'll admit I'm a bit afraid of things I don't know about.
But another resident, who only gave her first name Michelle, has no objections to a Mormon temple in her town.
They've existed in the U.S. for so many years. I visited Salt Lake City, where the church's headquarters are, 3 times. So I know the Mormon temple and everything about it. It doesn't mean I'm going to convert.
Church spokesman Evrard says a Chennai temple will allow French to discover his faith.
For us, it's a great opportunity to explain who we are, to introduce ourselves, and to say, yes, we have been here for a long time, we are here, and we are very present in society.
Mormon temples are closed to non-believers, but the Chennai project includes gardens that will be open to the public. With time, Evrard says, French fears about the Mormon community will disappear. Lisa Bryant, DW, Chennai.
There's another kind of controversy taking place across the English Channel, but it has just as much or little to do with religion. Most Brits would tell you they are not religious, yet Christianity is very much present in public life. Prayers are said before meetings in Parliament and in local councils up and down the country, but those days now seem numbered. Last month, the High Court ruled it is unlawful for councils to include prayers in their agenda. That's cause for joy for secularists, but Christians say it's a form of persecution against their way of life. Lars Bevanger with this report now from Manchester.
We pray for our elected members of the council, pray for the spirit of justice and truth, of wisdom and charity, that may motivate their service to the citizens of this borough.
A vicar says prayers at the opening of a council meeting in Oldham in Greater Manchester. It's been the custom in English councils since the times of Elizabeth I in the 16th century.
So may God bless this meeting and the work to be done tonight. Amen.
But this prayer could have been one of the last in Oldham and in other council halls across England.
I started as a councillor in 2007. And to my horror, they had prayers at the beginning of every council meeting.
Clive Bone resigned as a councillor in the town of Biddeford in the south of England when the mayor there refused to abandon prayers. Bone argued the council was a secular body which had nothing to do with religion. He then took the council to court, and earlier this month the High Court ruled in his favour, saying councils by law cannot have prayers as part of their agenda. Clive Bone calls it a very important victory.
And if you're not careful, you'll end up with councils, as I think we have to a degree, skewed in the direction of rather elderly churchgoers. Councils are for everyone, not just a few people. They're not private clubs, they're public bodies, and they should be neutral in that regard.
The Church of England has taken centre stage in public life for centuries. It also has a law-making role, with 26 bishops in the House of Lords, the upper house of Parliament. The Queen is not only the head of state, but also the supreme governor of the Church. Banning prayers from council meetings is seen by some as a threat to the greater role of religion in public life. Simon Colvert is from the evangelical Christian pressure group, the Christian Institute.
There are some judges who do take not just a secular but almost a secularist view of our national life, and that doesn't seem to reflect the way that most people think. 70% of people in this country choose to identify as Christian. Most people are very happy with our Christian constitutional settlement. We see churches on every street corner, we have prayers said in Parliament, we have bishops in the House of Lords, and most people are quite content with that. And we do not want to see all of these things eradicated, either for religious reasons or for cultural reasons. Most people like them.
Yet while 70% of people might identify as Christian, a survey by Christian charity Tear Fund showed only 7% of Brits consider themselves to be practising Christians. This puts the UK among Europe's four least observant countries.
The majority of the people are not practising or don't believe in God or Christianity, but it's still there. It's inconsistent with the multi-ethnic diverse culture that we have.
Guy Otten heads the Greater Manchester Humanists. He believes religion has gained far too much significance in public life and that council meetings are but a small proportion of the problem.
Maybe you're at a funeral or something like that, or a marriage. You've gone to support the bride or the bereaved or whatever it is, and foisted upon you are all these prayers and all these references to God, which mean nothing to you. And in the public context, it can get ridiculous. For instance, in the Remembrance Day ceremonies, which we have every year, it's all religious. And yet, you know, over 50% of the people there find that meaningless now.
The battle against prayers in council meetings has been won from the secular point of view, but the war is still on. The High Court ruling is being appealed, and the government has rushed through legislation which it says will allow local councils to do what they want during their meetings, including the saying of prayers. Legal experts disagree whether this new bill will actually trump the current High Court ruling. It seems the debate about religion's place in public life has only just begun. Lars Bevanger, DW, Manchester.
We have a new quiz question for you this month. But first, here are the winners from January, who were able to tell us that Greece and Luxembourg, not Sweden, were part of the original Eurozone. Kabahiga Germain from Kigali, Rwanda. Madeline Ridd from London. Matt Hedrick from New York, New York. Martin Kuiper from Rotterdam, the Netherlands. And Temesken Muleta Insene from Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. My apologies in advance for any mispronunciations there. And now for this month's quiz question. If you're a fan of films and books set in the American Wild West, then that music just might ring a bell. It's the soundtrack to a western called Old Shatterhand. But the film wasn't a Hollywood production. It's a German film, and it's based on a book written by one of the most widely read authors in the German language. He wrote numerous books set in the American West, even though he'd never been there. That author died on March 30th, 100 years ago. But who is he? If you think you know the answer, our email address is europe@dw.de, or you can write to us at Inside Europe, the European Desk, Deutsche Welle, Bonn, Germany. We have 5 prizes to give away, so best of luck with that. This is Inside Europe. I'm Gabriel Borud in Bonn. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Gabriel Borud in Bonn. Over the next half hour, we'll concentrate on media affairs around the continent. We'll start in the EU capital, Brussels, where journalists are now asking more philosophical questions as they scramble to cover yet another Eurozone summit.
What are we doing here? What is going on? Guys, please do it. You've got to do it.
We'll take a look back at how fallen Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi manipulated the media in Italy. And we'll visit a new generation of journalists in Bucharest who are disillusioned with the mainstream media in Romania. Those stories and more coming up on Inside Europe. It's not quite Groundhog Day, but it's starting to seem like that here in Europe, with yet another trumped-up EU summit dedicated to the debt crisis this week. There's literally an emergency summit almost every month in Brussels as leaders scramble to put forth plans to save Europe from financial meltdown. And every time they meet, somebody has to write about what took place. While journalists in the EU capital are darn near running out of ink as they look for new ways to report on Eurozone summits ad infinitum. One of those journalists in Brussels, our very own correspondent Vanessa Mach, gives us a glimpse now into the art of reporting on EU summits.
It's way past 2 a.m. here at the European Council in Brussels, and the coffee is flowing. At this time of night, coffee is the lifeblood for dozens of bleary-eyed journalists, waiting for equally weary ministers to come out and share the outcome of yet another round of crisis talks.
My name's Joshua Chaffin. I work for the Financial Times in Brussels, and I arrived here, I guess, 3.5 years ago, just at the beginning of the crisis. It has been one endless stretch of very long, dull meetings in a big, windowless room. So it's like going to synagogue, but worse.
You do hope that the thing would be sorted. It's going on for an extraordinary amount of time at this point.
Arthur Beasley from the Irish Times is one of the diehard followers of the Eurozone saga. And it says a lot that even he is now suffering from crisis fatigue.
On the eve of now, the second summit this year, after a year in which we had 8 summits last year, 7 the previous year, it does seem that we are not making a lot of progress.
I'm Stephen Castle. I'm the Brussels bureau chief of the International Herald Tribune, which is the global edition of the New York Times. The first European summit I covered was in 1990, and I have lost count of the numbers. There used to be a real sense of novelty, and people actually almost used to enjoy these. And I remember particularly the Portuguese journalists always used to have a sort of raffle at the time of the ending of the summit. But now it's basically once every few weeks, and I think the novelty is wearing off, and my only strategy is not to drink alcohol, because if you do, then it's completely impossible.
With dozens of summits under his belt, Philippe Ricard from the French daily Le Monde says he's learned the art of summitry, snatching valuable hours of sleep even when talks are in full swing.
The latest crisis meeting was not that tough for me, because I tried to sleep as much as possible at home. And I was very lucky to come right on time for the press conference. And so I wake up at around midnight just to check whether there was a deal or not. There was no deal. So I went again to bed. I woke up at around 4:30, just in time, in fact, for the press conference. All my colleagues were very jealous.
But aside from staying awake, the big challenge is how to keep the story alive. Last week, after 13 hours of marathon talks, a second aid package worth a staggering 130 billion euros was agreed for Greece, thereby averting a default. Big news, except that this is now the fourth multi-billion bailout in 3 years, and everyone is getting just a little jaded. Stephen Castle from the International Herald Tribune.
I can't remember who it was who said that this was both terrifying and boring as a story. And the EU has this ability to make even the most dramatic stories about bankruptcy of countries, about, you know, the complete collapse of a society, into a bureaucratic process. And of course, this is the big the modus operandi of the European Union, 27 countries, 17 in the Eurozone. Everybody has to agree, you have to find compromises. You know, that is how the thing operates. But it also means you have endless meetings which produce very, very little.
Many journalists in Brussels say reporting on the Eurozone crisis is like watching a slow-motion disaster as it happens, with EU leaders seemingly unable or unwilling to do anything to put a definitive end to it. Arthur Beasley from the Irish Times.
There are some people in these quarters who would say that the Eurozone crisis has led them to ask a very philosophical question quite frequently. What are we doing here? What is going on? Guys, please do it. You've got to do it. And I suppose when you stand back then and you ask yourself, why are we still here after all of this time asking these very same questions? The answer is because these questions throw up such fundamentally difficult political questions as between all of the main protagonists. And these are not only questions of politics, they're financial questions as well. And for leaders of big European countries to step forward in any appreciable way, they've got to step forward with a rather large check, and that is difficult.
For journalists, the ordeal is far from over. More checks will be signed and more late-night talks will be held. So where will it all end? That no one knows. Vanessa Mock, Deutsche Welle Radio, Brussels.
Well, many people might have thought that media magnate Rupert Murdoch was on the road to nowhere after last year's phone hacking scandal brought an end to his Sunday tabloid, The News of the World. But Murdoch's back in the game now, with the brand new Sun on Sunday hitting newsstands last weekend in Britain. So what's the verdict? Professor Richard Keeble is the acting head of the Lincoln School of Journalism in London. And here's how he felt after reading the first edition of Murdoch's new Sunday paper.
Predictably appalled, of course. My colleague on The Guardian, Roy Greenslade, commented on its soft focus that no major campaigns or this human interest focus Amanda Holden, a kind of television celebrity, page and page about her. What concerned me, actually, Gabriel, was at the very heart of the newspaper, a story about Iran. It was on page 9, Britain's plan for Iran war. And there was a comment by their so-called political editor, like it or not, Britain is going to war again in the Middle East soon. I find that really, really appalling journalism, and it's the kind of journalism I associate with Rupert Murdoch, and it's the least kind of journalism we need in this country now.
The editorial staff on the Sun and Sunday has pledged to meet high ethical standards in their reporting. Mm. Who actually are these journalists?
Right. Well, their names are all there. Nick Parker, Chris Pollard, etc. Colin Robertson. I'm sure a lot have carried over from the News International stable. Of course, Murdoch promised that those journalists who have actually been charged over Hackgate will have their jobs back until further action is taken. So there is an element of continuity I would have presumed.
Do you think the readers will buy these claims of high ethical standards?
I don't know. Of course, they were celebrating 3 million sales, which is good. I think people like me would have bought one for the kind of historical keep in the records. It needs a few more weeks and months to see if it can actually survive. But the British reading public is quite an interesting phenomenon. They buy newspapers, but they do not believe what they read. There's a great deal of skepticism about newspapers. As you know, tabloid newspaper journalists, some of the least respected professionals in the country. I think it's only estate agents and politicians at the bottom of the league for the least trusted. So the people do read newspapers with a great deal of criticism, contempt, and mockery. They buy it because it's what's on offer. It's the market. But it doesn't mean to say that they actually are accepting what they read at face value.
Would you say that British journalism has been irrevocably damaged
by such papers, by this phone hacking scandal?
It's always been problematic. There's been a long history in this country of inquiries following some scandal. There have been royal commissions, there have been inquiries, they've all pronounced, and none of them have had really much effect.
Professor Richard Keeble there, acting head of the Lincoln School of Journalism in London. From one media magnate to the next, we move now to Italy's fallen Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi and the media empire he used to gain power. At the end of last year, Berlusconi finally had to admit political defeat and step down from his podium that was built on his decades-long control of Italian media. From papers to radio to public television, he managed to do more than just manipulate politics, however. In the land of the Renaissance, where Michelangelo himself said that, quote, only God creates, the rest of us just watch, Berlusconi can be said to have shaped the whole of Italian culture. Danny Mitzman in Bologna now with this report.
Be Italian, be Italian. Take a chance and try to steal a fiery kiss. Be Italian, be Italian.
With three television channels, two of the country's most important publishing houses, and a Serie A football team, Silvio Berlusconi's not just Italy's richest man, he's its number one media tycoon. In 1994, he founded a political party called Forza Italia, taking its name from the football slogan, Come on, Italy! His media power became a key tool for building a political career,
a strategy
which took him from populism
to seduce the prime minister.
Undeniably, according to Gianfranco Pasquino, a professor of political science at the Bologna Center of the Johns Hopkins University.
He's an impresario, I think you would say in English, and therefore he produces some culture, and perhaps he produces the type of culture he believes is appealing for the kind of voters or perhaps for the kind of Italians he is trying to educate.
Taking a step back in time to his pre-political era, Berlusconi was undoubtedly a television pioneer. 30 years ago, he broke the state broadcaster Rai's monopoly, introducing commercial TV to the nation. A popular commentator for the Rai radio show Zapping, Gianfranco Pasquino says it was a good thing for Italian television.
It would be less lively, somewhat boring, and with less competition. And this would be bad. I would say the situation would be worse had Berlusconi not existed or not affected and the kind of changes that were taking place, the transformations that were needed. The Italian Rai, the public broadcasting system, was not bad, but it tended to be somewhat boring. Okay, Berlusconi has, in a way, obliged, in a way, provoked significant and to some extent positive changes as well.
Communications graduate Enrica Mancin grew up immersed in the culture of Berlusconi's new style of television.
When I was small, I remember there was a Rai television, and it was the state television, was very moralistic, very grey and very serious, and very boring. And then there was this bright and colourful television that was the Berlusconi television that was very colourful, very bright, many quiz, many fun programs like Drive In. The problem is that in Drive In there were plenty of semi naked women, and the camera was taken from down up, so you could see almost anything, everything. And it was almost like soft porn, and I was aged 8, so it was not the kind of good thing a mother would like her daughter watch.
As mesmerizing as it was, looking back, Enrica Mancin believes that the diet of television programs Berlusconi brought into Italian homes was the equivalent of cultural junk food.
I think that giving rubbish every day to television viewers, you contribute to the fact that they think rubbish. What you read shapes you. What you see shapes you. The culture you live in shapes you.
So what was Berlusconi trying to do? Gianfranco Pasquino says he was fed up with what he saw as left-wing intellectual control. He wanted to create a new TV culture that would appeal to the masses. And he succeeded.
To some extent, yes. Less political programs, more entertainment. That is, if there is a place where you can say that there was a major attempt to introduce infotainment, definitely Berlusconi, without necessarily knowing the word, was in favour of having more infotainment than just political programs.
One program which encapsulates this style is the hugely popular Striscia la Notizia, on air since 1988.
Nuove veline di Striscia la Notizia.
The show features a mix of satire, investigative journalism and, once again, those scantily clad nubile babes, one blonde and one brunette. Known as the veline, they perform a sexy dance before perching provocatively on the presenter's desk while the men introduce the next item. Mixing genres became Berlusconi's speciality. It also became his ticket to political success.
Siamo la gente della libertà. Presidente, siamo con te. Meno male che Silvio c'è.
Meno male che Silvio c'è, a rallying anthem with a pop video featuring smiling young people singing Thank Goodness for Silvio. Written for Berlusconi's 2008 electoral campaign, it's a perfect example of his media-embracing style.
The success of Berlusconi, it's strictly linked between television and politics. This is the problem.
Lucio Spaziante, who teaches media and cultural studies at the University of Bologna, has spent years critically observing Berlusconi's tactics.
Pop politics, where you have everything that is mixed. You cannot separate. You cannot separate public from private. You cannot separate media from politics. This is one of the most relevant problems. And during the 20 years almost of Berlusconi empowerment, you cannot separate the areas. This is the real problem. If we mix too much politics with media models.
In fact, the idea that a country's most powerful media magnate could simultaneously be its most powerful politician doesn't fit the European model of democracy. Yet no conflict of interest law was passed by Romano Prodi's preceding government, leaving the way clear for Berlusconi's return. Once he was in control of state television as well as his own commercial channels, Berlusconi made it increasingly difficult for his critics to get airtime. Most importantly, several popular satirists and commentators who were forced off the television.
Perhaps five of them, they did not disappear. They were purged. That is, he asked the board of directors of RAI not to hire them. He did not have the official full power to fire them. So there was some interference. Of course, he never liked them. In some cases, it is also a matter of skinning, if I can put it this way. He never liked them physically. He's a different type. Berlusconi believes he's a very elegant man and so on. And so he didn't like left-wing intellectuals who usually are not particularly elegant and not particularly, I would say, good-looking, if I can put it this way.
Go ahead and try to give my cheek a pat.
Image is everything in Berlusconi's media world, in which, as Lucio Spaziante explains, looks will get you everywhere.
We have many cases of girl coming from television programs or anyway people who doesn't have any kind of political skill who became a key figure in government, local government, or, for example, also ministers in Italy. For example, the veline became one of the model. One of the first veline became the girlfriend of George Clooney. Elisabetta Canaris came from this kind of experience. So in Italy, to be a veline, it means to be one of the most famous person in the nation.
Look at Nicole Minetti. She was a ballerina in Colorado Cafe with skirt half of her bottom, and then she was brought straight to the regional authority of Lombardia.
The problem is that when people asked why those kind of women were there, the political party of Berlusconi said it was not a relevant question. And with the passing of months and years, the question became unacceptable.
No longer prime minister, what should we make of Berlusconi's mixed media legacy to Italian culture? Lucio Spaziante thinks it's still too early to say, but Gianfranco Pasquino says there have been some positive effects, most ironically in the field of politics.
Definitely he has obliged the politicians of the centre, that is former Christian Democrats who were not particularly good on TV, to learn how to communicate or to try to learn. Definitely has provoked a change in the way the left is trying to communicate. The left has now understood that it cannot discuss philosophical issues, but it must provide precise answers, perhaps also in an appealing way. So he has changed the type of political debate one could find. That is not a sort of frozen political debate, but a lively political debate.
But turning politics into fun, easy-to-digest viewing, doesn't that amount to political dumbing down?
The debasing of political culture is not a phenomenon that affects Italy exclusively. It is a phenomenon that you will find in other countries as well. So Berlusconi has probably accompanied what was going on, perhaps probably added something, but he's not fully responsible for the debasing of world culture or European culture, of Italian culture either.
Viva l'Italia, l'Italia che ha scelto di credere ancora.
Berlusconi's populist media campaigning might have been totally convincing if he hadn't led Italy to the brink of ruin. Years of focus on image rather than substance finally caught up with him, and in November 2011 he was forced to step down. With his antithesis, the very non-mediagenic Mario Monti, running the show, perhaps the grand illusion has crumbled once and for all. Danny Mitzman, Deutsche Welle Radio, Bologna.
And I'm Gabriel Borud in Bonn. You're listening to Inside Europe. Anger that's lingering on the streets of Bucharest has not only brought down the Romanian government, it's also forged a new generation of journalists there. A group of independent reporters are seeking an alternative to mainstream state-run media. The Journalists' House, as the group is called, was started by a young reporter whose coverage of the protest violence has made him a minor celebrity in Romania. Tom Wilson's been talking with these journalists who are trying to change what they call the polarization of Romanian media.
Here in University Square in Bucharest, people are demonstrating about all kinds of issues, from environmentalists who are against a planned gold mine to the elderly fighting for better pensions. It's a revolt that's also shaking up the Romanian media. I'm here in Casa Giurnalistului, the journalist's house, where a group of young freelancers have shot to fame following their coverage of the protests using social media. Vlad Ursulan is just one of them. His articles about the protest have made him something of a celebrity.
You can attract a large audience. I've had tens of thousands of visitors for every article. They were the most liked things on Facebook during this period, and I did even better than the newspapers and TV stations on the net.
For him, it's proof that working outside the mainstream press works.
You're not just writing for your mum and your grandma. You can have a real audience.
Vlad was there when the violence first broke out in University Square, and he saw the battles with riot police from the front line, making him an overnight success.
La primul, cred că am avut 50,000 de vizitatori.
My first article, I think, had 50,000 unique hits. It was a huge wave, just from Facebook. Even the former Prime Minister, Adrian Năstase, paid me some small compliments. Probably he wanted a piece of my minor celebrity status.
These three rooms are full of journalists discussing their next step. Vlad is the man behind the Journalists' House initiative that's brought them together.
The idea is to bring together great journalists who have remained in Romania despite the tough times and who are spread across different media outlets in a single place for all kinds of events so they can get to know each other, encourage each other, to cry on each other's shoulders.
The journalists plan to split the rent on the apartment they're using, though money is something of a problem. Vlad makes his work available free on his blog and writes just a couple of columns that he's actually paid for. Despite this, he wants to offer resources that other freelancers can use.
We'll have a kind of editorial office for freelancers, people who write for all kinds of people and don't have a physical office where they can work. They can come with their laptops to write and talk to other people.
Oana Dan is another of the young freelancers here tonight. The Romanian media is grouped into large trusts that have strong party political biases. Many people also accuse the mainstream media of sensationalism and a dumbed-down approach to news. For Oana, it's something worth protesting about.
We haven't been there to protest as journalists. In a way, it could be a conflict of interest. But we've been out in University Square almost every night for 2 or 3 weeks. Each one of us has things to protest about regarding the way journalism has been degraded and lost credibility. I think that this movement and making an informal editorial office is our form of protest. We're capable of coming up with a real alternative.
She's extremely pleased about how Vlad is using his newfound success.
Vlad is riding a huge wave of popularity. He's very young, he's just 23. It's real success to become so well known at 23, despite not having any resources or support, not being part of a media organisation.
Flavia Constantin is a young freelancer and says that the Journalists' House is a revolution in itself. She draws parallels with the role that social media played in the Arab Spring uprisings.
We have to recognise this and give credit where credit is due. Without social networking, we wouldn't be here. And the people who've gathered to protest in University Square, that's how they managed to communicate. Facebook has been transformed into a newspaper that you look at more than the TV or other newspapers.
And so I leave the journalists to their discussions about what hot topics they hope to follow over the coming weeks. Fracking for gas in Romania, gold mining, and the situation of the ethnic Roma. The protests in Romania might have dwindled considerably, but it looks as though this new generation of independent journalists will have plenty to write about, even when they eventually end. Tom Wilson, Bucharest, Deutsche Welle Radio.
And that brings us to the end of this week's show. On behalf of producer Helen Sini, sound engineer Vera Jakes, and the rest of the team, goodbye. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn, Germany.